going to take place only in the courtroom. There's not a pre-hearing examination. They felt for the examinations to really be valid that a physician needed to look at and speak to the person and see the records and things ahead of time. And they realized that that would increase costs. And what they were hoping to do was they were trying to balance a lot of interests on the committee. And they felt that if there was one good exam plus the additional medical testimony and records that would be admissible under the bill, that perhaps the judge would have sufficient information and the other side would feel that there was sufficient information presented that it could go at that. What may happen if you're being an advocate for the other side is, despite all evidence, maybe you would like some contrary point of view, and that certainly would be available under this, and then I think likely there would be a third. But I'm just presenting what the task force did look at and was trying to balance a lot of interests and costs.
If there would be an advocate isn't even a question. Isn't this an advocacy system where the lawyer appointed doesn't have any duty
but to the client,
but to be an advocate? If they're following the ethics of their profession.
Mr. Chair, I believe that would be my...
What about, let me ask the two of you and then the committee, what would be wrong then with saying one or two and forgetting about the third under these provisions? What would be wrong with doing that as a way of cutting down potential costs and at the same time, rather than giving the court the authority to pick number three, you force the court into the situation where there are differing opinions and it's ultimately the court's decision anyway. What do you think of that one as an alternative?
First, let me reflect the reason that it is the way it is. With the judge adding the third, the...
We've got a 2-to-1 decision by the mental health people.
This was, as I recall, at the request of the member of the task force who was a judge, who felt that the judge should have the option of requesting a third.
And also puts less of a burden on the judge if the judge can look at a 2-to-1 decision.
But I think that is simply that was the rationale for that. One more comment about moving from one to three. I think we had heard some courts testify that they didn't have very adversarial kinds of proceedings, that both sides would listen to a good expert testimony and would put some faith in it. So
but
I think
that's a failing of the lawyers of that bar to do their job.
Well, there was a variety of testimony. Some counties were testifying that they felt that was much the better approach, and other counties were taking just the opposite point of view. We found it to be quite different across the state.
It's because there wasn't another side.
That's true. And of course, the other, as Kingsley points out, the another part of the bill was to make sure that there was another side represented through the district attorneys on the commitment hearings and the Attorney General on the recommitment hearings.
Committee members, leave it at three or look at the changing it to two where you still have the one option, which is what the chair would probably recommend. Can I get a sense of the committee?
Changing it to
the proposal I would make is no, not just keep it there. Have the provisions as they are now, where you only appoint one unless the person being committed requests number two, but then cut it off at that point and say, you don't get a third, the judge doesn't have the authority to appoint number three, but instead the judge then must make his or her decision based on those two opinions, rather than go to the third one appointed by the judge.
That's the only question.
I see it as a potential cost saver, and at the same time, It does. It would force the judge then, probably who's going to have two conflicting professional opinions, then to analyze those opinions and make his or her commitment decision.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you recall that when you had discussion on this, when the judge made the suggestion about the tiebreaker, was there any discussion at that time about the cost aspect?
I don't recall precisely, but the general theme of this all was that it would cost less, and therefore we'd be able to afford a more thoroughgoing examination. And that was
the general theme, though, Dr. Bray, wouldn't you say, would be if there were only two, it would surely cost less. If you had the option of one or two rather than one, two, or three, it would surely cost less. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Was there thought given? I know you're starting out with the assumption perhaps that in a lot of instances only one would be used, and that is probably advantageous cost-wise, certainly. Was there a consideration that you can recall that, well, in those situations where certainly the, as Representative Hanlon suggests, maybe the bar was more vigorous and always provided the second, would you think in those situations you're likely to get the third, and so really maybe you're going to save some where you just have the one, but you're going to pick up or go backwards where you get the third?
Definitely. If that happens, we would have a heavier fiscal impact every
but
time.
But have you thought about that during the task force?
I don't recall any discussion of that view. If we get the third, not being able to afford it, basically.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, I think at that point, the majority on task force felt that there wouldn't be a third. The Judicial Department thought that there probably would always be a third if there was a disagreement between the two. My recollection of Judge Norblatt's interest in the third after the decision been made for the two was the present system now allows the second one to be appointed off the list the court has, and the court makes that decision. He felt that, if I don't misspeak him, that with the first one being chosen by the court, the second one being chosen the defense counsel's choice, he felt that that meant there would probably be two differing opinions, and therefore he wanted the court to have an option at the court's choice off the list to have a third. And I think what he was trying to do was really maintain the status quo, which is right now there are two and they would come off the court's list. So I don't think cost was really the focus at that point, though the majority felt, the committee thought that there would not be this 1-2-3 thing happen. I think there will.
Chair? Question to you, since you have experience in this. The judge in that situation, if he picked the third, he's not necessarily persuaded by the third opinion. It might have some influence, but he could certainly disregard it. Isn't that correct?
Certainly.
So therefore, your proposition is that he's just really forced to, he or she, who's ever the judge, is forced to make that decision earlier based on the evidence of the prior two medical folks.
Yes.
Without airing additional concern about it, I think you might have a pretty good idea there.
Representative Dix is nodding affirmatively, as is Representative Bellamy. Counsel, can you, when drafting, put tentatively then put section 15 in the form where you'll have one or two, rather than one, two, or three? Dr. Bray, let's go to 16.
One more comment on 15. I missed one thing that 15 does, and it does it in a subtle way. A problem that was identified in testimony from examiners was that some physician examiners are not trained psychiatrists and don't have the background and experience to do this. And in the Mental Health Division provides training for non-medical examiners and has done so since 1974. this, the way this is worded now would require non-psychiatrist medical examiners to also participate in that training.
And so, now who can participate?
The people who participate in the training now are the non-medical examiners participate in the training. And that was the way that it was established in 1973. The training program is provided mostly for the non-medical examiners. We have testimony from medical examiners who were not psychiatrists that they felt that they could benefit from this training because it's useful in understanding the procedure. And so
you're confusing me, so maybe we'd better go back over it. Using the words non-medical examiners are confusing a layperson like me that knows that a psychiatrist has an MD after his or her name, a psychologist has a PhD, and then there are mental health professionals that have other than PhD or MD. So if you could put it in that language, I think I could understand it better.
Okay. If you look at line 18, a physician licensed by the Board of Medical Examiners for the State of Oregon who is competent to practice psychiatry. So that person could examine.
That's an MD.
That's an MD, and they can practice without taking the training. B is, on line 20, certified as a mental health examiner, qualified to make examinations. That would include non-MDs and MDs who are not psychiatrists.
Well, but let me just take that one step further. Non-MDs would include who? Psychologists?
Social workers?
Psychiatric
nurses?
Could it be the janitor down the hall here?
No.
Why not?
Because we certify non-medical examiners, and they have to have a degree. There is an administrative rule been written on the basis of the statute for certification.
Minimum standards are what?
The minimum standards include a graduate degree in a mental health profession, which includes a certified psychologist, a psychiatric social worker, psychiatric nurse, plus the fact that they've taken this training and successfully completed it, plus the fact that they have to have references from other mental health professionals who know their competence to do this kind of examination.
Who does it now? The wording is just examining physician or qualified person who shall be a resident of the state of Oregon.
The people who do it now are physicians licensed by the Board of Medical Examiners and certified mental health examiners. So all physicians can examine without taking the training. All this does is move non-psychiatric physicians into those people, into that group that need to take the training. That's the only change this makes in it.
How does it do that?
Well, it does it by qualifying how a physician licensed by the Board of Medical Examiners for the State of Oregon, it includes the phrase, is competent to practice psychiatry. That's the only person now who can examine without taking the training. Everybody else, including physicians who are not psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers and psychiatric nurses, and have to take the training.
Questions? Comments? Objections. Let's move on to section 16.
I'm going to go ahead. Section 16, the operative lines here, 29 through 31, this provides that the examination is initiated prior to the hearing, but doesn't make a failure to comply with the paragraph sufficient to grounds to challenge the examination. Then on lines 43 and 44.
Well, before you do that, they come and sit in the courtroom or wherever it is now. What do you mean prior to hearing?
In the way this will work is that the examiner would, if the person is being detained in a holding room in the hospital, the examiner would go to that holding room, would examine the patient in that place, and would have access, although this section doesn't provide for that, it's provided elsewhere in the bill, would have access to the record for the current holding period and could discuss the case with the treating physician.
Other changes in this subsection?
It just provides on line 43 and 44 for the division to make a rule about what should be in the examiner's report so that there can be more consistency in what the examiners are reporting, so we can begin to get a...
What about line 33?
Line 33 is current statute.
Changed, though, isn't it?
It is.
I'm informed by counsel that there well may be, and that's what makes this bill real difficult to plod through, that counsel that drafted this may have made some style changes that have no substantive effect. So when I ask you these questions, I'm not trying to be picky, but at the same time, if there's any substance, we should know.
Yes, I don't think there is here. It's just a change in from immediately shall be filed to say upon completion of the hearing, file the reports with the clerk of the court. I don't see any substantive difference in that language.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say, it's not substantive change from what's being done now. It brings what's being done now into conformance with the statute as written. Because right now they're submitting the reports directly to the judge, and to file it you have to go down and get it stamped, and what it means is it'll become part of the record as soon as it's entered.
The last part of this section is at the top of page 14, lines 1 through 5. And I have already spoken to that point in my earlier discussion. This is the part that allows access to the physician's medical records, investigative report. And deals with the privilege question raised in gaining that information.
Counsel?
All right, Doctor. Does this relate to records within the possession of the mental health division?
In some instances where the person is being held in a state hospital, they would be in possession of the mental health division. In other instances, if they were being held in a local hospital, they wouldn't be in the possession of the mental health division.
So under this section, you would be able, Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Sure.
You would be able to make rules, mental health division, that relate to the physician-patient privilege?
This rule would have to do with the holding period in the local private hospitals as well as... if it was in a local private hospital. Now, the division currently has a responsibility by statute to certify the holding rooms in the local hospitals, and we survey those facilities to make sure their safety, and we do raise questions about staffing and other issues that arise. This would extend that to include... we would just amend that current rule to include statements about the records.
Counsel, do you have further questions?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Well, maybe I do. You have other parts of this bill that relate to privilege and waiver of privilege. And can you remind me what they relate to? They relate to, number one, the records of the current commitment shall be accessible to the examiner. Is that correct?
That's right.
And what else do they relate to under the waiver of privilege? Records of what?
Basically, this bill doesn't go beyond the current period of detention. In other words, you can't go back and get into somebody's clinical records from previous, if they had had a psychotherapist previously or had been in treatment previously, that would not be, it doesn't extend into that, if I understand your question. The privilege is only amended to allow for the current period of hold.
Why don't we put that here rather than give you the authority to do it by rule?
It does do it here.
Where?
Where it says records and communications described in this subsection and communications related thereto are not privileged under ORS 40.230 or 40.235.
The physician patient privilege.
Right.
But no, that doesn't do it. All it says is records described here in this subsection, and then above in the subsection it says those records are the rules. Are as provided by your rule. Why don't we just say during the current commitment, the examiner shall have access to those records? Do you understand my question? If that's all we intend, why don't we just put it right in there?
I understand your question, and I don't see necessarily why it has to be by our rule, by the division's rule.
Is there an objection to having counsel draft something that would just state what Dr. Bray has stated, but let's put it in the statute? Hearing no objection, counsel, do you need some further direction on drafting that?
I can talk to Dr. Bray.
Okay. Did you have further comment on that, Dr. Bray?
Just one comment. Kingsley's reminding me of something that it was of interest to people. There's a lot of reliance on this record to get the necessary information into the court. And what was directed by the task force was that the division adopt a rule to outline what should be in the clinical record so that we don't have records coming into the court that are insufficient to provide the information necessary.
Oh, that's okay, counsel. Let me try and give that direction better and let you comment. We want in the statute to say what physicians' medical records and investigation reports that the examiner shall have access to. We want that right there in the statute, and that relates to the current commitment, if I understand you correctly, Doctor.
Right.
We also want to leave the latitude in for mental health to adapt the criteria that should be followed in making those records. Would that be fair?
Yes.
So if you could work on that, counsel. You got me? Mm-hmm. Section 17.
Section 17, the first change there occurs down on lines 38 and 39, where it states that the division may place a committed person in outpatient commitment under Section 19 of this Act. So this is the lead into the whole outpatient commitment situation. Basically, this means that once a person has met the commitment criteria, they don't and are committed to the mental health division, they don't necessarily have to be placed in a hospital, but can be placed in a community program. And the intent was to encourage community placement if at all possible.
And lines 20 to 26 were moved somewhere else?
Yes, they were moved to page...
I don't want to know where they were moved to. And lines 27 to 30 were referred to conditional release as in the next section.
Yes.
Comments, committee members? I think we'll move on to 18 unless there are comments. Conditional release, Dr. Bray. That was defined or addressed in the previous section 17 and is existing law.
That's right. Conditional release is existing law. The next change is in section 19.
Section 19. Well, wait just a second. We're in section 18. And section 18 is all new law.
Yep.
My section 18 is brand new law.
It comes from line 19 through 26, I believe.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Hi. Mr. Chair, it's existing practice under, it's the language they were asking where it got moved to, in section 17 from 19 through 26. However, it adds some things to it. Under this system, there would be a couple of options once there had been a decision that there was enough evidence to commit a person. They could be committed to the mental health division's custody directly, and then I believe the mental health division could put them on trial visit, which means they go in for a period of hospitalization and then would be released early under certain conditions, but they could be revoked. They could have outpatient treatment, which means they never went to the hospital first, but they were under the mental health division's supervision as worked out with their county, and they could also be revoked. Or the judge, without committing them, as I understand it, to the mental health division's custody, could directly put them in the custody of friend, relative, or guardian, and that would be conditional release, in other words. But what that exists now. The judge has that option, but there's no teeth in it. There's no one, they're not directly given to a designated person. That designated person, if the allegedly mentally ill person is failing to follow through with conditional release terms, there's nothing they can do to revoke them and bring them back in without starting a brand new proceeding. So as I recollect, what's added here is similar to what's done with trial visits and things is, there is an actual way to revoke the conditional release in a hearing that designates a person responsible to do that, and it just puts teeth into it so it will be a viable option because it's a good one to have.
So. Actually, this section, though, is line 19 through 26 with a style amendment. And the section that...
What page are you on?
On line 14. Line...
On page 14?
Yeah.
Lines 19 through 26. Yeah, I got it.
What section 18 does is take those lines and change the style in which they're accomplished. And Kingsley's absolutely right. Later in the bill, it prescribes procedures for outpatient commitment that are precisely the same or about the same as trial visit.
Section, we'll move on to section 19.
Section 19 establishes the provisions for outpatient commitment.
Is this something brand new?
And this is new. Line 16 through 34 is new. And says that we can only make this placement if an adequate facility is available, and that we have to establish conditions for outpatient commitment. And this parallels the way the current trial visits statute reads when somebody leaves.